around these simple things of everyday life, like how do we sit? Yeah. And I've got a bad back, obviously. And what helps me with my own pain is if I stand up every 20 minutes. So I've got a timer on my watch, and in 20 minutes time, the timer is going to go off and I'm going to stand up and keep talking. And that, that will also be an invitation for any of you. If you feel that you'd like to stand up, walk up and down at the back, lie down, anything, that's all fine. And you don't have to wait 20 minutes to do that. Yeah, so just use this evening as a space where you can do whatever you need to do for your body. We spend so much of our lives fitting into norms in society and thinking we've got to sit for ages because everyone else is sitting for ages. You don't have to do that here. And it's often these little things that can change our lives. You know, standing up every 20 minutes for me has changed my life more than formal meditation practice, which is always a slightly heretical thing to say. But there's many hours of the day when one isn't meditating. And so finding the confidence to be able to do what I need to for my body in my daily life, that's been massively life-changing. Yeah, so as I said, we've just been on Sky having a holiday, and I've had a very, very demanding year. My mother died last June. My father died this March. My twin sisters had cancer and various other family things. So I've been on my holiday, and it's like someone's pulled the plug out, and I've just been feeling really, really tired. And yesterday I was trying to prepare for today, which was laughable, because I just could not string two thoughts together. In fact, we had a meeting with a friend of ours on Sky, who's a trustee of our charity, and that was also laughable. So he's a very, very bright, sharp man, and he was looking at me very intensively and telling me all this stuff, and I couldn't even focus on him. It was fascinating. Like, my eyes would not focus on this human being in front of me because my brain was just...
switched off.
My brain was switched off, yeah. So I'm saying all this by way of contextualizing how I'm going to be tonight and what I'm going to share. I feel really, really passionate about what we're doing. And actually, now that I'm here, I feel like my brain is
turning on.
I'm
going to help.
But earlier today, I was thinking, oh my God, you know, is it just kind of cotton wool in here, or is it actually a brain? Anyway, we'll see how we get on. But yeah, this is another part of the work, is to be authentic and honest about, you know, how I am right now. But I've got Sonia here as a prompt, which is fantastic. So this wonderful theme that Jerry's given us, which is going beyond secular mindfulness, which is very intriguing, which is partly why we wanted to come, because I thought that's a really juicy topic. And going beyond, of course, can mean going beyond in the sense of secular mindfulness isn't very good, and we need to go on to something better. And, you know, some people in the Buddhist world do have a view somewhere on that spectrum. Or it can mean going beyond in the sense of kind of going alongside. So secular mindfulness is really, really good. And you can also go beyond and learn about other things to do with Buddhism. So that's the way I want to approach it tonight. That secular mindfulness, I believe, has got an enormous role in our society, in the modern, predominantly secular world that we live in. So I'm a great, I'm a passionate advocate for secular mindfulness. And I'm an ordained Buddhist, so clearly I'm also a passionate advocate for the full Buddhist path. So my idea is that you have these two paths kind of running in parallel, rather than one being the poor cousin of the other. So that's something I wanted to say at the beginning, and I'm going to be unpacking that. A little bit about what is breathwork. So Jerry said in that lovely introduction, thank you very much. So Breathworks is a secular mindfulness organization that specializes in mindfulness for health, so mindfulness for people with pain and illness and stress that's impacted on their health. And then we've also got a mindfulness for stress course, which is for high functioning stressed people, so people who just feel their life is a bit crazy and they'd like to learn some skills to manage their thoughts and manage their emotions and so on. So we've got these two programs that we run. And we're also a teacher training organization. So Sona and myself, we formed the organisation in 2004, based on courses that I started running in 2001, and I'm going to say a little bit more about my own personal story in a moment. So Sona and myself and Ratna Guna, also known as Gary Hennessy, we started running courses in Manchester in 2004. They were really popular, but we realised that three people in Manchester was not going to have a very big impact in terms of the suffering in the world, in terms of the millions and billions of people who live with chronic health conditions and mental health difficulties. So we decided at that point to train other teachers so then they could go out into their communities and then they could offer our programs. So we've now got teachers in 25 countries. We've got something like 350 teachers worldwide. We've got teacher training programs in the Spanish-speaking world, in Spain, Mexico and Argentina, teacher training programs in Germany, and we teach in Australia as well as in the UK. We've got 12 people now employed in our offices in Manchester and London. And all this just seems, I think, wow, am I making this up or is this all true? Because it just seems incredible. But it just goes to show that there is a need. You know, in the current political climate and the period that we've developed our business, you don't survive as a business unless you've got something that the world needs and the world wants. We've survived the big financial crash of 2008, which was a big test, you know, of a lot of small companies. And, you know, we've not only survived, but we've thrived. We still don't make a lot of money, but we've thrived in the sense of really expanding our business. I think our turnover is something like £500,000 now, isn't it? Yeah. So going back to why have we done this? Yeah, we could have just been me and a couple of my mates thinking, let's make something up that would be a good thing to do for the world.
And what we
did. Yeah, I know that is what we did, but it had a root. It had a passion behind that. And that passion came out of my own life story. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my life journey and how I got to the point of feeling that I wanted to offer this work to other people. So I come from New Zealand, and I like saying that in places like the Highlands because I think there's quite a lot of similarity between the wilderness of New Zealand and the wilderness that we've been driving through in the Highlands. Even down to the midges, because we've got sand flies in New Zealand, which I think are probably exactly the same thing, with a different name and a southern hemisphere version. But very, very sort of interesting, a lot of similarities. And on my father's side, my ancestors came out on the first boats from Scotland to New Zealand. So that's another nice connection with you guys. So I was brought up in New Zealand. I was very sporty, very outdoorsy, did a lot of mountain climbing, a lot of tramping, as we call it there. I think you probably call it hiking or hill walking here. What do you call it in Scotland?
Hill walking.
Hill walking, yeah. We call it tramping, which is hardcore in New Zealand, but I think it's probably pretty hardcore here. And so I had a body that was healthy, vital, alive, and that I took for granted. And then when I was 16, I injured my spine I was lifting someone out of a swimming pool in life-saving practice. And my spine started to hurt, so it wasn't a big dramatic injury. It was something that came on over time. And it turned out that I had a condition called spondylolisthesis, which is where you get a fracture in the vertebral body and your whole spinal column shunts forward at that level. So it was quite severe. So I had various conservative treatment, and then I had a fusion operation when I was 17. Complications from that, I had another very big operation 6 months later. So by the time I was 18, I was living with chronic pain, and I was no longer this sporty, athletic, outdoorsy person. So I was going through a major crisis of identity on an emotional level as well as a major physical crisis. I wasn't using a wheelchair at that point, so I was able to still get around, but I've had chronic pain ever since then, which means daily pain ever since then, which was 40 years ago. When I was 25, I had some treatment that went horribly wrong, and I ended up in an intensive care ward in New Zealand. Very, very ill and very, very scared. And I had an experience one night that completely changed my life and was the root of me doing this work. Yeah. So I'll just tell you about that very briefly. So I had a particular test during the day, which meant that I needed to sit up for 24 hours afterwards. And at that point, I hadn't sat up for months because I'd got to a point of another physical crisis prior to this. So I was in this very interesting position where I had to do something that I couldn't do. Yeah, so it's very sort of, we have these times in our lives where we have to, find another way through an intractable problem. So I was being asked to do something that I couldn't do. So there I was sitting in this bed in absolute agony, and I had this voice in my head saying, I can't do this, I'll go crazy, I can't get through till the morning. It was all about getting through till the morning, which is when I could lie down again. So I can't do this, I'll go crazy. And I had another voice that said, but you have to. So I can't, I'll go crazy, but you have to, you can, I can't, you can, I'll go crazy, no you won't. So I had these two voices that were getting tighter and tighter and tighter. It was the most intense experience of my life, I would say. And it was a real dark night of the soul. It was the middle of the night in an intensive care ward. And then out of nowhere came a third voice. And the voice said, you don't have to get through till the morning. You just have to live this moment and this one and this one and this one. And my experience changed. And I thought, yes, I can do that. I can live this moment and this one and this one. And I got through till the morning and I felt profoundly changed. I think because that voice came out of such enormous intensity, it had an extraordinary impact and clarity. So I got through till the morning and all my ideas about time had unraveled. Because I knew viscerally, in every cell in my body, life is lived in just this moment and this one and this one. That's what it means to be human, to be fully alive in each moment. So then what is the future and what is the past? All these questions came up for me. And if time begins to unravel, then space begins to unravel. So the whole kind of fabric that we live within, we just sort of go along thinking about, you know, expecting that tomorrow will come along, and we believe everything about the past, and we're all caught up in the story of me. All that began to unravel. And even who am I? That began to unravel. And a deep questioning awoke in me. Who am I, and what does it mean to be alive? And how can I live my life in each present moment? Because I tasted that in the middle of the night. I tasted that vivid sense of presence in a way that I'd never tasted it before. And I wanted to do that again. Well, how would I do that? I knew nothing about Buddhism. I knew nothing about any kind of philosophy about present moment awareness. I had been brought up an Anglican, but it was very nominal. So you wouldn't call me a religious person by any stretch of the imagination at that point. And yet I think I'd had what many people would call a religious experience. And then a couple of days later, the medical team sent the chaplain to see me. I think they really didn't know what to do with me because there was no medical answer to my situation. The message was, we can't do anything to help you. You're going to need to learn to come to terms with it and manage it as best you can. So they sent the chaplain along, very, very lovely man, who took my hand and he said, I want you to remember a time and a place when you were happy. So I took my mind back to the Southern Alps of New Zealand, where I had been ecstatically happy climbing. You know, you sort of slog up a hill, and then you look out over a wilderness. You know, that feeling of just complete ecstasy of the beauty and wonder of nature. So I took myself back there, and then, I don't know, it might have been 10 minutes, he brought me back, and I felt completely different again. I felt that my subjective experience of being this girl lying in a hospital bed had changed radically by what I'd done with my mind. So I just got to have a little sip of water. And that blew my mind. Because up till then, I'd never considered that I had a mind. I was just living my life, and I was alive because I wasn't dead yet. But I'd never, ever thought about awareness, or the fact that I could be aware of my own awareness, or the fact that I had a mind that I could choose what I did with. No one had ever told me that stuff. So I had this experience where this person invited me to choose what I did with my awareness and where I placed my awareness, which was on a happy memory at that point. And my subjective experience profoundly changed. So then I thought, wow, I really want to learn how to live in the present moment, and I really want to learn what is this thing called mind. What is this tool that I have, you know, in my, well, I thought it was in my head, but these days I think it's everywhere. I had this tool that I could possibly train so I could no longer be a victim of my own, where my awareness went, but I could learn to train my awareness so that I could cultivate happier states. I mean, none of it was that worked out, of course, at the time, but that was the deep intuition. And the other main thing I learned when I was in hospital was about self-responsibility. Because up till then, I definitely had not taken responsibility for my own health at all. I kept thinking there was somebody out there who was going to fix me. But I was in hospital, and the medical message was, no, there's nobody out here in the world who can fix you. It's up to you to take responsibility for your own health as best you can. I think that's a much stronger message these days. This was in the 1970s in New Zealand, where the whole idea of self-responsibility around health was not a well-developed public health message. So it was very shocking, very, very shocking. And I felt I had a choice. I could do that, or I could just keep on being really, really unhappy and have these periodic crises. So I thought, well, okay, I'm up for that. I'm up for taking responsibility for myself. I'm up for trying to figure out what is the present moment, and I'm up for trying to figure out what is my mind. Yeah, fantastic. You know, so I went home from hospital a completely different person. Prior to that, I'd worked in the film industry. I never went back to that work because it was completely the wrong job for somebody with a really bad back. 60-hour a week minimum contract, sitting all day long editing. So I've never gone back to that. And I came out of hospital thinking, this is my sort of mission in my life, is to figure out how to be fully human and live with a body that's damaged. And I intuited, perhaps surprisingly, that my mind was at least potentially healthy. I don't think my mind was healthy, but I remember I had this phrase, a very clear phrase in my mind. My body can be broken, but they can't break my mind. Very interesting. I don't know who they was. They can't break my mind. My body might be broken, but they can't break my mind. So there was something to hold on to, that I had this potentially remarkable resource within me, which was my own mind and my own awareness. So fast forward, that was in 1985, fast forward to 2000 in Manchester. Had a number of other crises, which I won't go into. But I got to a point where I thought, I have discovered, to a certain extent, how to have a really good life with this body. Yeah, I'd come in contact with Buddhism. Very quickly, got very heavily involved in Buddhism in New Zealand once I come across it, because I thought, wow, this is a whole tradition which is all about the mind. That's brilliant. That's exactly what I was looking for. And it's got all these skills about how to train the mind. So that was brilliant. And it had a fantastic community of people. So I was meeting other people who had the same kind of burning questions. So I got involved in Buddhism there, came to live in the UK at a retreat center. So I lived at a women's retreat center for 5 years. Very intensive training, very, very good, very demanding, but very growthful. So I got to the point in about 2000 where I thought, maybe I've got something I can offer other people. Just maybe. Let's just see. So I got a small grant from the Millennium Commission for disabled people who want to contribute to the community. This was at the point when the government still had money to give away in grants, so I was very lucky, actually. It was very, very small. I think it was £8,000. And the idea was that I would come up with a program and teach it to people in Manchester. I had no idea whether people would be interested, and I had no idea whether I was any good at doing this, and I had no idea whether I could do it physically, because my back was very, very bad at that point. So I put an ad in the local paper and was overwhelmed by the response, which I was quite shocked by as well, because the ad was, do you have pain and illness that you find really difficult to live with? Would you like to come on this mindfulness course? And I didn't really know people like me. That's the other thing that often happens when you have a chronic health condition. You can feel quite isolated, and you look out into the world and you think everyone else is fine. Yeah. So it was very interesting that I was hearing these stories from all these different people saying, I really need help, and I've got a chronic health condition that there isn't really a medical answer for. So I think we filled the courses for the whole year in about 2 weeks of advertising. And I started running the courses, and they seemed to be well received, and I was curious that a little bit went a long way, because I wasn't a good teacher then. I didn't really know what I was doing. But it seemed that sowing the seeds of awareness training and giving people some tapes at that point, audio tapes, of body scans and breathing meditations, even though I felt I wasn't very skilled at what I was doing, it was still having a very big impact on people. So I was very, very encouraged by that. And my vision was to come up with something that a girl in a hospital bed like me had, like I had been, that a girl in a hospital bed would be given access to this course, you know, in a book or a teacher. So rather than being told, there's nothing we can do for you, and you need to just learn how to come to terms with your condition, bye, it would be, okay, we know this really good course that you could go on, or we've got this teacher that could come and see you, or here's this book you could read. So my whole vision behind Breath was, has always been how to reach people like that 25-year-old girl lying in that hospital bed, yeah, who would never, ever, in a million years, have gone to a Buddhist center, which comes back to the secular mindfulness and the Buddhist peace. Yeah, how to reach ordinary human beings who are suffering, who perhaps aren't interested in religion. And just to give you some idea, has my time, I've got 1 minute, 44 seconds to go. To give you some idea of the scale of the task, about 1 in 3 adults lives with a chronic health condition, a long-term health condition in the UK, 1 in 3. So a chronic or a long-term health condition is something that where there isn't a cure. So it's diabetes, heart disease. Cancer is increasingly a long-term health condition. The treatments are so good now that people aren't necessarily dying of cancer, but they're left with what's called lasting effects of the treatment. Yeah. Asthma. And increasingly people are living with multiple long-term conditions. An aging population, sedentary population. So the scale of the problem is really increasing. When I started doing this work in 2000, most of the NHS budget was spent on acute healthcare. Yeah. 70% of the NHS budget is now spent on chronic health conditions. So we're seeing this huge shift from the weight of the problem being acute problems to blossoming, that's not the right word, a burgeoning problem of more and more people living with multiple chronic health conditions. Yeah. And the most recent stat I heard around mental health is that 2 out of 3 adults in their lifetime will experience mental health disorders. Yeah, 2 out of 3, that's huge. And it's massively increasing. So the scale of the problem is huge. We have, I don't think it's inaccurate to say we have an epidemic of chronic health disorders in the Western world, in our societies. And I think mindfulness is very, very well placed to meet this problem. It's what we call a self-management program. So we're teaching other people skills to help themselves. So that's very, very good. It's relatively cheap. It's group-based. Doesn't require lots of high-tech equipment. And it's effective. There's an increasing evidence base showing that mindfulness programs are very effective in a wide range of situations. Obviously, we're specialising in health, but it's used increasingly in schools, education, prison service, and the workplace. Um, So my mission and my passion has always been how to reach the heart to reach people. Yeah. How do you reach the people who are really suffering in isolation out in the world? The people that would not even come on a mindfulness course, certainly not come to a Buddhist center, but they're suffering in isolation and alone. So that's my deepest passion. So I've written three books, but my second book, Mindfulness for Health, was written in particular to try to reach a very wide audience. I wrote it with a Daily Mail journalist, because a Daily Mail journalist is extremely good at speaking in a language that a lot of people can understand. A guy called Danny Penman, and he's a master. So the mindfulness can be presented in a complex way, or it can be presented in a very simple way. So we tried to write a book that was very simple. And it's just a couple of weeks ago been launched as a book on prescription in the UK. I don't know whether that includes Scotland, but that's fantastic. And it won first prize at the British Medical Association Book Awards a couple of years ago. However, recently I've discovered, because of my mission about how to reach people, 50% of the adults in the UK have a reading age of 11 or less, and 1 in 20 have a reading age of 5. Yeah? So even writing a book that's very accessible, it's not reaching the hard to reach people. Yeah? So now the next thing I want to do is an illustrated version of Mindfulness for Health, and I want to do a lot more online stuff. Because I think most people have access to the internet, most probably, need to do more research. But it's always about how do you get the message out, how do you present these ideas that can be made complicated or they can be made simple in a way that's very, very accessible, very immediate, anyone can do it. And what we've found with our work is 10 minutes of meditation twice a day that can have a huge effect on people very quickly. You know, you don't need to meditate for hours a day to begin to have an impact. So what we're doing with secular work, I would say, is aligned with the teaching of our Buddhist teacher was a guy called Sangharakshita, and he founded the Tibetan Buddhist Order, of which I'm a member, and that's why I'm wearing this scarf as my very tiny robe. So it's a modernized Buddhist tradition, and when we get ordained, we get what's called the kesa, which is the equivalent of a robe, but we don't wear robes because we're a modernized Buddhist tradition. And one of the things that Sangharakshita has said right from the start is that the first stage of spiritual growth is to become a happy, healthy human being. So Buddhism talks a lot about going beyond the self and how the fact of the self is an illusion. It talks about the emptiness of all phenomena. But the first thing we need to do is to become a happy, healthy human being, to have a good, stable, psychologically healthy sense of self. That's a really, really important part of a stage on the path. And I would say a lot of what we're doing at Breathworks is helping people become happy, healthy human beings. And I would not underestimate or diminish the value of that. Yeah, it might not be talking about enlightenment, but becoming a happy, healthy human being is what a gift to move from being an unhappy person to a happy person, or a person who's tormented by their pain and illness to a person who's able to live well with their pain and illness. That's a fantastic goal for any human being. But this is where going beyond, I've only got 8 minutes left, but I'll touch on this and then I'm going to say more about it later. Is there anything beyond being a happy, healthy human being? That's an interesting question, isn't it? That may be enough for many people. But what the Buddha taught is that yes, there is more to life than being a happy, healthy human being. That you can become a human being who's wise, who's compassionate, who's broken free of any kind of reactive suffering, and lives with a perspective of deep, deep interconnectedness. So rather than me being a separate, isolated self, I'm co-creating my experience of life with all you guys. Yeah? So none of us are going to leave this evening exactly the same person that arrived. Right now, I'm talking to you, I'm making eye contact as I look around the room. That's affecting me. I'm picking up from your expressions. Are you going to sleep? Are you awake? Do you look confused? Do you look engaged? And then because of that, I'm changing. My body language changes a wee bit. And then you see that, you change. Yeah. And that's a much more accurate sort of doorway into something of what the Buddha taught. that all the time we are kind of co-creating our experience of life with other people. And when you see that very deeply, you want to become a person who does no harm. And you want to become a person who's benign, who's kind, who's connected, who's engaged. Because every single moment, our mind is having thoughts that have effects on other people. And I do really believe that, actually, that our thoughts also have an effect on other people. What we say has an effect on other people, and how we are in our bodies, our physical actions have an effect on other people. And there's no single moment when that isn't happening, which is really shocking and awesome. Yeah. There's no single moment when we're not sending ripples out into the world. And they can be destructive ripples, or they can be benevolent ripples. Now, I wouldn't teach that to a person on week one of a breathworks course, because that's too much. It can be overwhelming, especially if you're someone who's tormented by your suffering. Then you feel you're kind of polluting the world by your actions. Well, you'd never say that to someone in week one of a breathworks course. But I would say it to somebody who comes to a Buddhist center. And I might say it to someone in week eight of a breathworks course, which is this: how do you open the doorway to a deeper perspective? I would say the difference for me between a secular mindfulness course and a Buddhist context is the overtness of the transcendental ideal. It's implicit in mindfulness courses, definitely. So mindfulness courses come from the Buddhist tradition. All the different mindfulness courses, they're all seeded by a guy called Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was a Buddhist and a scientist working in the States in the 70s. And he developed something called mindfulness-based stress reduction. And breathworks is an offshoot of that. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is an offshoot of that. Mindfulness-based relapse prevention for addicts is an offshoot of that. So they all come from him, who had trained as a Buddhist. And his vision was, can we translate these ancient Buddhist teachings in a way that's accessible to the modern world, particularly to deal with healthcare initially? Yeah. So it comes from Buddhism, but we don't call it Buddhism, mainly for pragmatic reasons, because a lot of people you're going to get on courses aren't interested in religion. They might be Christians, they might be Muslims, they might be Jews. We'll take anyone on our course. So we draw on Buddhism without calling it Buddhism. But if you go to a Buddhist center, then for myself, as a Buddhist, I feel I can really take the lid off. And then you can offer the whole path. You can offer transcendent wisdom, transcendent compassion. And the great thing about Buddhism is that it's got a very profound ideal of the fact that it's possible to be completely and utterly free, mentally and emotionally, and it's possible to be completely and utterly compassionate. And it's got 2,500 years of teaching from many different cultures that we can draw on, from India, from Tibet, from China, from Japan, from Taiwan, and so on. We're able to draw on all that to offer to people who are interested in Buddhism. There's an explicit ethical basis, which is very, very important: do no harm. Now, that's implicit in secular mindfulness courses, but we don't make it explicit, partly because we've only got 8 weeks and there's only so much you can do in 8 weeks. So Buddhism's got both these extraordinary ideals, but it's also got a very pragmatic path. So that's one thing I really love about Buddhism: it's both the ideal and it's the path. Very, very practical, very down to earth. There's almost like a sort of manual you get from the Buddha. If you do these things, then growth is assured. Well, that's great, isn't it? So we're able to draw on all that in a more Buddhist context. So one of the ways I've been reflecting on this myself, just sit down for a moment, is that I think a lot of what we do at Breathworks and on secular mindfulness courses, I would call teaching people how to let go of. So you're letting go of resistance to your pain. Yeah. So the model we use is to distinguish, say, physical pain, my experience of physical pain, into two components that we call primary and secondary suffering. And the primary suffering is the actual unpleasant sensations in the body. And the secondary suffering is the great weight of mental, emotional, and physical tension that arises through the resistance to the unpleasant sensation. So you've got something unpleasant and immediately you get this great kind of weight of, I don't want this, I don't like this. And then you get mental states that are in conflict with your experience. You get fear, depression, anger emotionally, and you get loads of secondary physical tension. So you've got physical pain, I don't like it, and you hold against it, and then you get more pain. Yeah. All that secondary suffering is optional. So what we're doing on our whole 8-week program really is helping people to accept the primary in each moment, because it's just moment by moment, it's flowing, and to reduce or even overcome the secondary suffering. And the distress, the real human distress, comes with the secondary suffering, not with the primary suffering. And it's so gloriously simple. You, through following certain techniques, certain methods, you can really reduce that great mass of secondary suffering. So I would say what we're doing at Breathworks is very much letting go of. We're letting go of this vice of I don't want this, this kind of aversion, the resistance, the pushing away that causes so much pain. So how do you let go of that? How do you rest and flow? How do you open your heart and your mind to be less conflicted? Yeah? But then there's a fantastic question that arises, which the Buddha answers very well, which is, what are you letting go into? Yeah, you're letting go of, but what are you letting go into? Is it a vacuum? Is it nothingness? Is it a void? Is it dull? Or is it luminous, wondrous, expansive, loving, rich, interconnected? You know what? It's a fantastic question for you all to sit with. When you let go of the clinging and the grasping and the aversion and the resistance, what arises? What comes pouring into that space? Yeah. And the Buddhist tradition is very, very good on this, particularly the Mahayana, the Vajrayana, the later Buddhist schools, where you get images, get loads and loads of imagery of all the different archetypal Buddhas that all represent different aspects of the free mind. So you have, they're all coloured, so you've got green and red and gold and white, blazing, still, dark blue, and they've all got gestures and they've all got symbols and they've all got beings flying around them in the sky. You get carvings of them, and they all represent an aspect of what pours into that space when you let go of fighting with your life. Yeah. But what's very interesting is that there's this whole non-conceptual, non-rational, non-cognitive aspect of Buddhism, and that's difficult, more difficult to place into the secular work. The main way we do it is with poetry. So people use a lot of poems on secular courses, which I think evoke that kind of mysterious heart response. But in Buddhism, there's this huge iconography of the inexpressible. Because the other thing that is a tremendous kind of conundrum in Buddhism is the Buddha saying that the ultimate truth is inexpressible. It's beyond words, it's beyond language, it's beyond concepts. So we have all these, you know, you come to a Buddhist center and you hear all these words about that which is inconceivable and that which is beyond cognitive understanding. Yeah. But what you get given as well is all this richness, these figures, these colors, the myth, the story, the symbolism. Yeah. So later Buddhism is incredibly rich in this respect. And I think for these reasons, it's a bit like when you let go of clinging, when you let go of resistance, what pours in is completely wondrous, but you do need to have some doorways. But the doorways are not just rational and they're not just cognitive. They're all this colour and richness and symbolism and so on. So there's a lovely story from the time of the Buddha where there was a big assembly of monks at one point and he held up a flower. He didn't say a single thing. He just held up a flower. And he looked out to the great assembly and he could see that one person had gained enlightenment because he held up a flower. One person had understood the complete truth from a flower. I mean, that's just bonkers from a certain point of view, isn't it? And yet, that was the beginning of the Zen tradition. The first teacher of the Zen tradition was the person who understood the truth by seeing the Buddha hold up a flower. So what the way it's often described is that all the teachings are a finger pointing to the moon. Yeah. So all the teachings that we get, I think, you know, the secular work is the same. We're opening a doorway. So it's a finger pointing somewhere else. And so, but you need the direction, you need the finger to point you towards something which is beyond, something which is, well, I don't really understand it, but I've got such faith. So it's a faith response. You have a faith response to the fact that there's something more, there's something beyond, that it's not just a sort of a vacuum that you're letting go into. You're letting go into this incredibly rich, loving, pure, utterly transformed perspective on life. Yeah. So I'm just going to finish very, very briefly, going back to my own personal life, my own personal journey. So how do I hold these two paths? Because it's quite interesting, isn't it? I've got the work with Breathworks, which we do in the health service, we do in the workplace, where getting ourselves in a position where we can tender for big contracts and we can, you know, go in and teach loads and loads of people how to manage their pain in the health service. Amazing, yeah? I can't do that saying we're teaching Buddhism. Of course I can't, because they don't want Buddhists in the health service. In fact, with the current climate with radical Islam and so on, I would say there's even more concern about religion. Yeah. So we have to be very, very squeaky clean that we're not a religious organisation, and we're not. We're very clear, we're teaching mind training and heart training that's entirely free of religious affiliation. I'm completely passionate about that work. I totally love it. Yeah. And I'm completely passionate about inviting other people through the doorway into this illumined, wondrous, glorious vision of the Buddha. Yeah. So how do you do those two things? And for a lot of the time I've been doing breathworks, I've actually experienced quite a strong conflict. You know, quite a strong personal conflict of where should I be putting my energy? What should I be doing with my life? Yeah. Because the Buddhist path is obviously the goal. You know, so vast and so it's a kind of supreme goal of complete freedom, complete love. And the secular work, that's implicit, but the goal is how can you manage your pain better? How can you be a happy, healthy human being? Yeah. So it can look like a lesser goal. But I resolved it with an image, because I realized in my heart, actually, I just need to keep doing both. That helped me resolve it. Rather than it being an either or, I realized, actually, I just need to keep doing both more and more and more until I pop, and then something will happen. It's kind of like tension is considered a really good thing in Buddhism. These kind of tensions and conflicts, we sit with them, we work with them, and something new comes into being. Yeah, and it's a false dichotomy anyway, I realized eventually, seeing them as kind of either or. They're both going in the same direction, and I need to do both. Yeah, and the image that came to me was of a sun, a blazing sun in a dark sky. And there's rays of light going out from the sun into the darkness. And the work that I do as a Buddhist, and with our order, I'm right at the heart of the sun. So I'm sitting in this light. It's not like I'm not the sun, but I'm sitting in this really kind of radiant, glowing place with my brothers and sisters who have got the same goal. Yeah. And the work that I'm doing with Breathworks is where the rays of light touch the darkness. So it's just at that very point where you've got something that was dark becomes lit. It becomes It becomes no longer dark. It becomes illumined. And that one person who was dark a minute ago, maybe they've got some hope. Maybe they've got some light in their lives. Yeah. And of course, that's not a dualistic image. That's a synthesized image where you've got the sun, you've got the rays of light, and you've got the darkness, and they're all part of a seamless whole. So that really, really helped me when I came up with this image of the sun. It just came to me one day. And of course, that also speaks to what I've been talking about in this talk. It's non-conceptual. It's not like I didn't sort of sit down and think it through, but it came to me as an image. It came to me as a symbol. It came to me almost as a myth, you know, the myth of the sun and the darkness. And I knew in my heart, that's my kind of resolution. I just need to keep doing both. And I need to somehow find some balance in that, which is always a great mystery, how one does that. But the image of the sun, I want to leave you with that. And then the question of going beyond secular mindfulness, even that question becomes a non-dualistic question. Like they both sit in the same sky. They both sit in the same sky. So thank you very much. Just have a 15-minute tea break, then we'll start at 25 past, and then you'll hear from Sona. Thank you.